probe itself, or was I physically changing the capacitive reactance of the device? What actually was going on? It was really a mystery.
Okay, and this is a good piece of physics. You will admit that had you taken the carriage of the undisturbed slotted line with an open circuit on the output end, as you move the carriage forward and reverse from the null, you would be coming out of the null. I'm pretty sure you can see. You can see that because you've experienced it. The null occurs because there was an odd number of quarter wavelengths between the output open circuit and your probe. The probe itself, the output end of your slotted line, has an open circuit. That's a point where there was maximum voltage. Whenever you've got a standing wave and you know where the maximum voltage is, a quarter wave away from that, back down the line, there's going to be a null. There's going to be another null, a half wavelength from that. Every odd number of quarter wavelengths, you're going to get a null. So you had tuned it to a null. It was an odd number of quarter wavelengths. When you add any dielectric material alongside of that semiconductor of the slotted line, between the open circuit and the location of the probe, any dielectric materials you add changes the velocity factor. The velocity factor used to be unity because it was air. You're adding something else. As you add any other material, the wave in that region where you've added the material propagates more slowly. As the signal propagates more slowly, that signal says, hey, that's not an odd number of quarter wavelengths anymore. It's something a little bit longer than an odd number of quarter wavelengths. You therefore electronically moved out of the null by changing the electronic length between the probe and the open circuit. I know you're going to have to think about this a few times to see the principle. Had you done the experiment by putting these dielectric materials on the input end of the slotted line, had you done it on the input end, between where you're injecting the signal and where the probe is, you would see almost no change. Whereas the output end is very sensitive because the null of the probe only found a null when it is an odd number of wavelengths from the open circuit. Over to you, John, K2LIW on the TechNet.
AC2WGB. Well, actually, that piece of cardboard or paper that I was putting in there was between the input connector and the carriage. But don't forget, at the frequency I was working, there were five nulls or four nulls in that span. So, and also, if I would slide that paper toward the carriage or away from the carriage, it would make a big change in that amount of attenuation also. So there's a lot of things going on there, but I understand what you're saying.
Had you only been putting your dielectric materials, paper, Teflon, whatever, plastic, in between the probe and the output open circuit, there's where you're going to get the maximum effect of material placed there, and you now find you're no longer at the null. When you're putting materials on the other side of the carriage, the other side of the probe, on the transmitter side, now the effect is a different effect. Now, the number of wavelengths between your signal generator and the carriage doesn't matter. Let me give you an example of that. Assume you're not putting any materials in the slotted line. You've got an open circuit in the output. You have 1,000 megahertz going into the slotted line. You've moved the carriage back and forth until you found a null. Without moving the frequency of the signal generator, if you unplug the piece of coax cable between the signal generator and the slotted line and plug in a brand new piece of coaxial cable of a longer or shorter length, the carriage would still be at the null. The null is there because it's a certain number of wavelengths, an odd number of quarter wavelengths, between the carriage and the open circuit of the slotted line. The number of wavelengths on the input end doesn't matter. However, when you now start putting, you start putting dielectric materials in that space between the input end of the slotted line and the carriage, your dielectric materials are now starting to launch other modes of signal into the dielectric materials. Your probe is no longer just sensing the voltage on the semiconductor of the slotted line. It's starting to sense some of the signals that you've launched into your dielectric materials. Ordinarily, there is a symmetric chunk of air between the two plates. And now you're starting to put other materials in there, and signals are being launched into those materials, and those signals have a certain capacitive coupling effect to your probe. So only when you move those materials somewhat close to the probe did you see that effect, is my guess. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, it was there was a 2 points between the probe and the input where the signal came in that I could cause that to happen. So there were two locations as I would move it horizontally along, keeping it in the same depth, and move it back and forth. It was just some strange things going on, but I'm starting to understand a little more from what you're telling me. I'm also going to try, now you said once I get the determination of a null, if I were to put another 50 foot of cable on the input, it's going to still be the null at the exact same location. That's interesting also, so I'm going to have to try that out. But now I understand what you're saying with the open end and where the reflection is taking place. If I were to put this dielectric material between the carriage and that portion, I should see something different. That I didn't try yet.
When you do it between the carriage and the output open circuit, putting your dielectric material, you're going to see a much stronger effect. You can make the effect even stronger by moving the carriage further away from the open circuit end, so there's more wavelengths of material, of slotted line, between the carriage probe and the output. But now, you know that as you move the carriage along the slotted line, you do see nulls, and in other places you see a peak. And if you're using your Hewlett-Packard 415, the standing wave ratio indicator, you notice that you set it up for full-scale deflection on the peak, and then you move to a null, and the number of volts or dB of difference between the two tells you standing wave ratio. But now, let's find out where that null really came from. Let me drop it. There was a signal traveling down that slotted line, in your case at 1 gigahertz, from your signal generator. That signal everywhere along that slotted line, the forward-going signal, everywhere along that slotted line, exact same amplitude of signal going forward. I don't mean the slotted line has no loss. It's got a little bit of loss. But the output end is going to get a slightly weaker signal than the input end of the forward-going signal. The forward-going signal sees the open circuit because you didn't put a termination on the output end of the slotted line. Some signal starts reflecting back, almost all of it. As the signal reflects back, because you've now got a forward-going signal and a reverse-going signal, at some particular point, those two signals along the line are co-phase, at other points they're antiphase. That's what creates the peaks in the valley. There has to be a certain number of wavelengths between the output end, where you've got the open circuit, and the place where your probe is set up in order to find those nulls. Those nulls are at every odd number of quarter wavelengths. Because you're at 1 gigahertz, the wavelength is something like 30 centimeters. I think it's 30 centimeters.
150 millimeters is what you will measure between nulls, and you have to double that and divide it into 300. It comes out to 1 gig. Perfect, Dick.
150 millimeters is 15 centimeters. 15 centimeters is a half wavelength. So every half wavelength, you've got a null. Another way of looking at it is the nulls are occurring at every odd number of quarter wavelengths. You've got a null at 1 quarter, 3 quarter, 5 quarter, 7 quarter, and so on, wavelengths. Yes, the nulls are a half wavelength apart, 150 millimeters, because you've got a 300 millimeter wavelength that you're using. So the number of wavelengths between the output end and your probe determines whether or not you're at a null or at a peak. So by you putting dielectric materials in between the carriage and the output end. And if you want to have more space, I mean, every 30 centimeters, yeah, you probably have 3 or 4 knolls you can find. If you move the carriage further away from the open end, you now will have more of those knolls in between. You now have more space to put in dielectric materials. When you put in the dielectric materials between the carriage and the output end, you're going to see a stronger effect because you're changing the velocity factor of those multiple knolls in between the carriage and the output end. So up till now, you've been putting dielectric materials on the input end. You're going to get a much stronger effect on the output end, John, because now you're really changing the... Let me drop it. You're changing the velocity factor of the slotted line, and now that's a direct motion of moving the knoll. The knoll, by the way, will move closer to the output end. When you put some dielectric materials in there, you slowly put in some dielectric material, and you see the knoll come up a few dB. You'll notice that if you move the carriage slightly closer to the output end, you will refine the knoll. That will be a confirmation of what you've done, is you've really changed the velocity factor in that area where you've added dielectric materials. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
EC2WGB. Yeah, this is just a wonderful experiment that it went on for hours. I know we've got to get over to Paul because it's getting late. It's quarter after already, so I'll end it for now. But thanks for the update and that information, and I'm going to test that out and try it. And by the way, maybe Paul has information on ice that was found on Mercury on the polar regions. There's a large deposit of ice, which I was not aware of. I think it's something new. We'll find out. Over to you, Dick. Thank you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, it's real good that you started doing these experiments on a slotted line, because a slotted line is a beautiful situation of a thoroughly electronically closed coaxial cable. But because of these great big slots that do not radiate under normal conditions, now have ways of climbing in there and doing all kinds of experiments that'll tell you what is really going on inside of an ordinary coaxial cable. In normal circumstances, an ordinary coaxial cable, the outer shield keeps you from finding out what's really going on inside. But with a slotted line, you can easily climb inside there with all of your probes, pieces of equipment, and pieces of dielectric materials and metallic materials. You can have a grand old time finding out how coaxial cable behaves under various conditions, because you've got this kind of transmission line, coaxial cable, so to speak. It doesn't look like a coaxial cable. It is electronically a coax cable. Let me drop it. And therefore, you can do all kinds of experiments of putting in dielectric materials with permittivity, permeability, conductivity. Oh boy, various shapes, various orientations. There's a zillion things you can do with this that'll slowly teach you a hell of a lot of the electromagnetic theory experiments, where now you're seeing it in real time, in real life, and it's not just a bunch of equations on the board. So, as a teaching tool, you are developing an extremely good teaching tool. I'm a little bit amazed that our favorite scientist at MIT, Walter Lewin, I'm a little bit amazed that Walter Lewin hasn't discovered these kind of experiments you're doing on a slotted line. He could have had a grand old time with this one. Hey, Paul, what's going on in space, as if I didn't know that a lot's going on. WS2N with the space report. And I think this is going to be space report number 172 of the series. K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
This is WS2N, space report. Very good. As John mentioned, ice on Mercury in the poles where the craters are. I know that was information that's been being diagnosed from the end of the Messenger mission. Messenger was up there for quite a few years in orbit around Mercury. It's the only spacecraft that we had in ever, in around that planet. And toward the end of the mission, they eventually crashed it into the planet. The pulse, you know, they diagnosed all the data that came back, and they find large amounts of hydrogen, and they believe that, you know, the chemistry of whatever they look at tells them that there's, you know, ice down into the, buried in the parts where the sun never goes to, at the poles, like you said, John. Let me drop it. Couple of things going on, not all that much, but there's a EVA coming up on Wednesday from the International Space Station, where Lynn Grabe and Scott Kelly are going to do an EVA. They're going to go out to put insulation on the alpha magnetic spectra, you know, the telescope that they put up there a couple of years ago. They need to cover that. Some wiring and cables they're going to reroute. It's going to be his first EVA since he's been up there in March. You know, Scott Kelly, he'll be up there for a whole year next March. Him and his fellow crewmate from Russia. So I'll be looking at the EVA and see what else they're going to be doing. I haven't seen much information about it yet. He was supposed to do an EVA a couple of months ago to attach the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, to the space station, but that was put on hold because that unit that was being brought up was inside the Falcon 9 that blew up in June. That's been rescheduled. There was supposed to be two that would be eventually attached to the space station. And that was going to be the first one, and then the other one. They have spare parts, and they've been working on putting another one together since the other one blew up. And eventually they'll be doing that next year. And then they'll have two docking ports for crews once those things are attached on the American side, as well as two berthing ports for equipment and cargo that will be going up there. One thing I wanted to mention that next week they're going to start in Texas. SpaceX is going to start testing the Dragonfly. Let me drop it. Elon Musk named his either cargo craft or the crew craft that goes up to the space station, the Dragon, and then there's the Dragon crew vehicle, you know, which will eventually be actually bringing crews to the space station. And there's this one now called the Dragonfly. I talked about this probably about a little over a year ago on the net. And it's going to be a test vehicle that they'll be using down in Texas. He has a location down in McGregor, Texas, for testing rockets. And the idea of this is the goal for SpaceX is to bring crewed spacecraft back to the space station through the atmosphere, eventually without parachutes, just propulsion, and land them on land. I mean, that's the ultimate goal years from now. But to do that, they need to test the rocket system to do that. Let me drop it. So you can imagine what the amount of testing that they're going to do. This craft, which is, you know, it looks like the capsule that goes up to the space station with the trunk on the back, has rockets inside, eight different rockets, and they're called the Super Draco rockets. And these rockets are, you know, going to have multiple purposes. One of them is going to be for emergencies. Let's say the Falcon 9 is sitting at the launch pad, Launch Complex 41, getting ready for a launch. and something goes wrong with a rocket. It's about to explode. These rockets inside the capsule, part of the spacecraft, will immediately launch the crew away from the rocket, bring them to safety a mile or two or into the Atlantic Ocean. Now this thing has been tested. In fact, it was tested last May. They did just that. They used Launch Complex 40, and they put it on the without a rocket. Simulated a rocket attachment sitting at the Cape, and they launched. They launched this crude vehicle out into the water. And it was very successful. All the rockets on the Super Dracos lit up all eight, and it worked out very good. They decided that they were going to take the same spacecraft with the rockets and use that for another test out in California, except on a rocket that was flying, simulating going up to space. Well, that's all been canceled. Delays that are occurring now since the rocket exploded last June. They've changed schedules and they thought about it and they decided, well, let's not use this spacecraft and let's wait another year or two and we'll actually use rebuilt crewed vehicle, and we'll do that test a year or two from now, and instead of California, they're going to do that in Florida. But what are we going to do with this nice spacecraft that we tested down in Florida that was successful? They're calling that the Dragonfly. They were going to make their own Dragonfly, a separate one, but they decided to make this one the Dragonfly, and they're going to have multiple tests and starting next week. And they'll start off hanging this thing from a crane, and they'll launch the rockets and see if it takes off and if it could land properly without crashing. And that will eventually change. Eventually they'll do away with the crane, they'll fly it higher, to 1,000 feet, and then they'll bring it back down. That's the goal. Even before they get to that point, they'll take it up on a helicopter, they'll drop it from the helicopter and see if it lands. And this is going to go on for a couple of years, so I'll be following it, and I'll give you updates and see if this thing is able to make some over 30 different tests over the next couple of years. Again, for the main purpose of eventually bringing a crew back without pressures right down to the ground from orbit. Sounds fantastic. In the beginning, when you first see the crews going up in 2 years to the space station, they will be coming back on parachutes, and they won't have a propulsive landing, but that will develop over time. So that's pretty much it. There's a few other things going on, but I think for now we'll just leave that. For questions, we need some time. This is WS2N, SpaceNet Report, for the TechNet.
Yes, at least two things that I'd like to ask you some questions about. First of all, Mercury is like one-third or one-quarter the distance between us and the Sun. It's a very close planet. As such, it runs hot as all hell. I don't know exactly what surface temperature Mercury has, but if somebody told me it's 800 or 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, I'd believe it. And then, such a close planet to the Sun, so darn hot at the poles to have ice, is kind of hard to believe. But if you think about it, with essentially no air, I think Mercury has very little magnetic field. It has no atmosphere. Therefore, there's no way it can couple heat from the hot areas to the cold areas. And the poles get almost no sunshine, so the craters at the poles can be real cold. And what little bit of moisture is left on Mercury can gather there and freeze into ice, is my guess. You're going to give me, when I pass it back to you, some words of confirmation on that. In fact, let's start on that one before I go to the next question I've got on the AMS. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LAW. What roughly is the surface temperature of Mercury at high noon? Got a guess on that one?
You're right about 800 degrees, and it's cooler than Venus. Venus is like 900, and Venus has all that, all the clouds and everything gets, you know, trapped in there. The pressures are tremendous, like 90 times the amount of pressure we have here on Earth. So they're like 900 degrees, Mercury's at, you know, a little over 800. So, yeah, and in the beginning, with all these comets coming down, they'd say, well, that, you know, they hit the, you know, they hit the poles, the ones that hit the poles, never evaporated. But also they say there's hydrogen being blown off the sun all the time, and that might be mixing with the, you know, I'll call it the regolith, the soil in the Mercury's, you know, land, and some kind of, sometimes creating a reaction and forming water. They think that's what's happened on the moon, too. Although there's a lot of ice, similar situations with the poles of the moon. Also in the soil, just, you know, even on the equator of the moon, there's trapped water in the dirt that's there, the regolith. Again, being created by, they think, from the sun's rays, but the hydrogen that's hitting it all the time, reacting with the soil and breaking something up. And I don't know the chemistry behind it, but releasing some kind of oxygen and forming moisture and, you know, buried in the soil, and somehow that migrates over time to the poles. I think that's another way of creating water.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Is it confirmed? Then I'm not really sure. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Venus has a lot of greenhouse effect. That very dense atmosphere on Venus allows the solar radiation to come in and doesn't allow very much of the infrared radiation to come back out. So by the greenhouse effect, Venus runs pretty hot. I think you said around 900 Fahrenheit. I've heard that the surface atmospheric pressure on Venus is 150 atmospheres. You've heard 90 atmospheres. In either case, we'd be very unhappy on the surface of Venus. Even if you had the real good air conditioning system and you can tolerate the 800 and some odd degrees Fahrenheit, the next problem would be that that air pressure. Even 90 or 150 atmospheres, that's a huge amount of pressure. That's worse than being in a pressure cooker. Now, most things obey the inverse square law. When it comes to a radio signal, every time you double the distance between you and the transmitter, you get one quarter of the amount of power. Let me drop it. That also happens, I believe, with solar wind, because Mercury is roughly one-third the distance of an astronomical unit between Earth and the Sun. Mercury is like one-third that distance. And three times three is nine. So the amount of solar wind that Mercury sees is probably at least nine times greater than the solar wind that we get. That solar wind is charged particles moving at roughly a million miles an hour on the average day. And when you get a CME, you get a hell of a lot more of them. So the coronal mass expulsion that we see occasionally, a big blob of that gets aimed at the Earth and creates what Dennis was calling EMP, but I'm going to call it a great big voltage buildup because of the charged particles hitting the Earth. Mercury is going to be getting that almost 10 times greater. That's a rough place to be. You wouldn't want to be there. Surviving that would be pretty tough. If by some magic you could get there real fast before you get hot and land at the poles in one of those craters, you might be all right. But that's a risky place to be. Now, the AMS, Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. Let me drop it. I think that was installed on the space station a couple of years ago. This is essentially the most powerful cosmic ray detector we have ever made. Remember I told you that the cosmic rays, no matter where you measure them, eventually your machine's going to be saturated. Every so often, Mother Nature does something out there, a gamma ray burst or whatever, where cosmic rays are some ridiculous amount of energy. come pouring into the Earth's region. It will saturate the meter. So the alpha magnetic spectrometer has a much higher saturation number, so that by making that measurement above the atmosphere, they would find out not only how strong do the cosmic rays sometimes get, but you also have the ability to measure antimatter, positrons, positively charged electrons, and the AMS has seen a good number of those. So some of that missing antimatter, we didn't know where the hell it was, is starting to see some clues of it on the alpha magnetic spectrometer. So the alpha magnetic spectrometer has been making these beautiful measurements for the last couple of years, accumulating all of these positrons. Let me drop this. And you said that this EVA that Kelly is about to do is going to put a cover over the AMS. What's your guess, Paul, as to why they're covering it? Are they covering it to act as a shield of certain kinds of particles so they can make other kinds of measurements? That's a guess. I mean, if you've got a radiation, if you've got a Geiger counter, and you put certain kinds of plastic and paper and one and whatever in front of your Geiger counter, what gets left is the particles that penetrated your shielding material, and therefore you're getting a different kind of measurement, which is valuable. So I wonder if that's what they're doing. WS2N, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, I was trying to figure it out myself. I mean, I made a guess at what was kind of what they're doing. You know, I thought they wanted to keep any kind of heat, infrared heat, away from this thing. But I don't know if that's important for this, for the AMS. But they are, you know, it's definitely going to be insulation. The only thing I'm thinking of is part of the spacewalk, or actually the main part of the spacewalk, is to reconnect connections that were disconnected a couple of years ago, back in, I think, 2011, when they had problems with an ammonia leak outside the space station. And they went out to repair, another crew went out to repair it, and it turned out the leaks were, they disconnected a lot of things they thought was going on. They found out the leaks were really coming from somewhere else. So because of that, they're now allowed to rehook up these radiator panels. You know, you look at the space station and you have these humongous solar panels all over the place. And you also see other panels, darker panels, and nowhere near as big, but they're pretty big. And they're radiating panels to get rid of the heat inside the space station. And I know one of them is near where the AMS is located. Let me drop it. And my guess is when they turn that back on, they do this spacewalk, you know, reconnecting that, is that that's going to be giving off heat. Not that it has anything to do with the AMS, and I just see that, you know, they're doing it at the same time, so I really don't know yet. These panels are always facing in the opposite direction. If the solar panels are looking head on toward the sun, these are always looking edge on at the sun. The idea is to radiate infrared heat. There's no convection, so you can't just get rid of the heat like you would normally, you know, think of. These are really infrared panels running ammonia through it, liquid ammonia, and there's no refrigeration system involved. It's just a pumping system. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's a beautiful experiment of conservation of energy going on here, Paul. Your solar panels are collecting photovoltaic energy, electrons, let's call it, and making some number of kilowatts of electricity. Those kilowatts of electricity, by way of the conducting cables, go into the International Space Station and run various pieces of equipment. Let me pick a number, 10 kilowatts of electrical energy into the International Space Station. By definition, you are creating 10 kilowatts of heat. I don't care what the instruments are doing, what kind of measurements they're making. Ultimately, that turns into heat. Light, heat, something is causing heating. And those radiating panels are supposed to dump the heat back out outside. because those radiating panels, some of them were disconnected, your ability to dump heat was compromised. Therefore, I am guessing they were limited as to how many pieces of electronics they could turn on until those radiating panels are back in operation. Is that a possible explanation there, John? Paul, WS2N, K2LAW.
They had everything running. No, there's no shortage, but they do like to have this hooked up. You know, there's no experiments being sacrificed or anything. Well, I understand everything is on, but they need, you know, they always need more. Redundancy. They always need redundancy, so you want to keep these things going in case another panel fails. They're kind of missing that redundancy. So very hard to get rid of heat inside the space station or any orbiting spacecraft, including the space shuttle. Remember, cargo doors opened up with inside those cargo doors, but they have those long radiators that ran almost the whole length of the cargo doors, and they were getting rid of heat that was building up inside the space station. So it's a constant problem. Skylab, the same thing when that failed. First crew that went up there, you know, opened that door, and they said it was 120 degrees, some outrageous heat number in there. They had to get rid of the heat. That was the first thing that they had to do in Skylab. Let me drop it. I wanted to mention one programming thing coming up. It's going to be in December, where I can get, it's going to be a show especially about the James Webb Space Telescope, and both Discovery Channel and Science Channel will have it early December. My guess is NOVA always has their own show, and they always compete against them. I love PBS's NOVA show, but I haven't read anything that they're going to have anything about it. But this particular show is going to be dedicated to the James Webb Space Telescope. And if you don't have cable, I guess we'll have to make a disc and send it to you or something. Back to you.
I think James Webb Space Telescope was in the news recently because of a particular milestone they just created across. I think it was the alignment of the mirrors. I think the mirror alignment procedure was tested out, I think, in a vacuum temperature testing chamber. And those mirrors, once they're unfolded from their storage position for transport, they have to be aligned to the nearest millionth of an inch or something like that in order to have 20th of a wavelength of accuracy of those, what is it, something like 17 panels altogether? One very big mirror. By the way, getting back to the AMS, Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, because there is a heat radiating panel nearby, let me drop it. I'm going to make a guess that you're putting some insulating material over the AMS so that the heat of those panels doesn't get coupled into the AMS. And the insulation you put on the AMS, it could be a reflective item, you know, like aluminum foil, so to speak. So the heat hitting it reflects back out into space. And a thin layer of aluminum foil is not going to have much of an impact on the AMS because it's looking at very high energy cosmic rays. Those very high energy cosmic rays penetrate almost anything, including the AMS itself. And as such, I think the insulation they put on is going to be a minor perturbation that's calibratable. I wonder what's the total number of heat radiating panels that are on the International Space Station, and how many of them were disconnected that are about to be reconnected. Do you know the total number of those panels? And do we know anything about how many watts they can dissipate? WS2N, K2LAW?
I think it's 8. This is probably one set that has been down. The Russians have some on their side as well. So No, I don't earn them. It's an awful lot. They have heat exchangers inside of a node, picking up the heat from all the electronics and everything. So there's actually no ammonia inside the station itself. They're in the external part of each node. So pretty safe. But, you know, I mean, it's possible that some ammonia could get into the station through some of the piping. And they always practice for that in case there's an ammonia leak. In fact, alarms have gone off. In case of an emergency, they all go over to the Russian side of the space station. Everybody wants to know why. But if they ever had to abandon ship, that's where the spacecraft are, the two Soyuz spacecraft. If you're stuck on the American side, there's no way out. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think you'd be coming back down in the Soyuz. Is that the true, Paul?
Yeah, right now there's two Soyuz spacecraft attached to the space station. You need a seat for everybody, so there's six people on board. So there's just two spacecraft. And there's Progress spacecraft attached. Actually, two of them attached right now. So we got one going up in December to, not Progress, but Orbital Science, ATK, Cygnus spacecraft with 7,200 pounds of stuff. A lot more weight than the old Cygnus spacecraft took up. It's an enhanced version, so we're doing better as time goes on. Back to you, Dick.
7,000 pounds, which I think is quite a bit more than the Progress can bring you up. You told me once before, and I've forgotten, Paul. Rough guess, what's the total number of kilowatts that the solar panels on the International Space Station can generate? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I should have memorized by now. Around 80 or 84,000 per set, a little over 200,000. But they degrade over decades of time, so they say, you know, maybe there's 10% less now. An awful lot of kilowatts. And yeah, Progress is around 5,000, so. But we're doing a lot better. The Japanese one had even more weight that they bought up on the H2. They're around 10,000 pounds on their craft. But that only goes up an average of once a year, where the signals will be going up probably maybe three times a year.
So you're telling me that close to 200 kilowatts, when they're brand new, of electrical power generating capacity exists in those solar panels. Is that the number? 0.2 million watts over your pole?
Yeah, I think it was roughly 80,000 per set. Some number like that. Wait, 64. I'll have to check. But yeah, I seem to remember around 200,000, a little over 200,000 kilowatts.
Gee, that's an awful big number. Is there any chance that we've slipped the decimal place by 10 to 1? It's really 20 kilowatts and not 200 kilowatts. 200 kilowatts. Wow. That's like a good fraction of a city of private residences. Over your call.
What was 40 homes? Same as, what would 40 homes be? Without me getting on the internet, I'm trying to guess that.
On average, a home, if you average over a 24-hour period, the average home is in the vicinity of 1.5 kilowatts. Of course, when you turn on your dryer and your electric range, you get a great big number, but it's only there for a short period of time. 1.5 or 2.0 kilowatts per house. 40 homes would be 80 kilowatts. So you can see why I'm a little worried that we've slipped the decimal place here by 10 to 1. 200 kilowatts. Wow. Even though they've got an awful lot of volume, I don't think there's enough heat radiating capability to to handle that. So we'll have to double check on that electrical power. Obviously, they can generate a lot of electrical power. And I think they were having a little bit of trouble on those rotary joints, the slip joints by which all of that current goes from the solar panels into the space station itself. I'm guessing the raw solar power goes into inverters that turn it into 120, 240, 480, numbers like that. Probably 400 cycle power is my guess. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
And I have a question. Will you get a chance?
Go ahead, Paul, and then pass it over to John.
Yeah, the rotary joints were fixed probably 2009 or something like that. So, and the last space shuttle up was about 2011. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the number, but maybe when John's talking, I'll get back on the internet and look. All right, go ahead, John.
Yeah, John, you've worked on some pretty high power electrical systems. How would you like to maintain the electrical system on the International Space Station? Over to you, John.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of joules to me. What are they doing with all the power? All right, I have a question. Maybe Paul or you have an answer. Does that planet, Mercury, rotates upon its axis? I don't know the period, but it's rotating. Do we know the temperature differential? The sun side is 800. What is the other side? Because I'm wondering, how is that ice there with conduction taking place in that soil? Or maybe that soil is thermally isolated in some way, because it's really freaking me out with ice on the pole. I realize the sun doesn't manage to hit it, but you would think with conduction, with those temperatures, it wouldn't have a chance. Over to you, KC2WGB.
If we have a sudden heat spell in Arizona, and you would think by conduction, well, we're going to feel it in New York. Yes, in a way, but the major transport of that thermal energy from Arizona to New York is through the air, the weather. The weather is what conducts it. 1 mile of soil is an extremely good insulator. Yeah, you and I call insulator the stuff you stuff into the walls of your house, where you've got a certain temperature outside, a certain temperature inside, and you want very little heat to flow through a couple of inches of foam. So a couple of inches not having very much heat flow, you and I call that a good insulator. If the thickness of the insulation in your wall was a mile, that wall could be made out of copper. A mile of copper, thermally speaking, is an insulator. See what I'm saying on this one? So if you think you're getting conduction through the soil, I doubt it. And because Mars has almost no atmosphere, usual transport of heat by the atmosphere is not taking place. And the thermal conduction through miles of dirt, you can consider that dirt an insulator, what you're talking about, a mile of it. That's my guess as to what's going on here, Paul. I mean, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
All right, Dick. That sounds good. Because I'm wondering, you look at the crater that the ice is in. So let's say the crater's 20 miles in diameter. Might be smaller, I don't know. And then you look at that parapet. Well, that parapet, basically the sun side is probably at that 800-degree temperature like the surrounding soil. Now you've got a very short distance from there to the ice. And I just don't, I can't fathom that ice being there with those kind of temperatures surrounding it. But you may be right. It may not be, the soil may not be a thermal conducting system for that distance. All right, good answer. Thank you. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
For a whole lot of years, we used to say that Mercury always faces the same face toward the sun, and I think it makes one orbit around the sun in 88 days. So we used to think Mars rotates once in 88 days. On further measurements, we suddenly discovered it does, it is not sun synchronous. It's got a 2-to-3 ratio between the rate of rotation and the rate of revolution. So it is slowly turning its face toward and away from the sun.
It's not active internally, I believe. Is that correct?
There, I'm not sure. Because it's so darn hot, it could have an active core. If it's active, got an active core, it could have a magnetic field. I'm having trouble remembering anything about Mercury's magnetic field. I wonder if you happen to have any words on that one, Paul. Well, we're giving him a lot of assignments. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, no magnetic field at Mercury, from what I remember. There's no liquid core, so I think that thing is locked up. I did find the, on the NASA site, I just couldn't find it on Wikipedia, but 120 kilowatts total right now. That's what they're looking at. So we'll see. I found one that was more. Let's go 120 kilowatts or less.
That's still a lot of steam by my standards. 120 kilowatts, if that was on a 120 volt line, I think that's 1,000 amperes. Yeah, 1,000 amperes of 120 volts. Boy, that's a lot of steam. An extremely well equipped private residence. It has two families. Make that main fuse panel go for 200 amperes. 1,000 amperes at 120 volts. Wow. Just the sheer heat of that in ETUs. I can see why you've got approximately 8 heat radiators. And during the time that one of those heat radiators was not working, didn't have that particular backup, I bet you there could have been a particular experiment they'd like to run that gives up a lot of heat, and they held off until the next radiator is ready to run. I think you told me those radiators have ammonia circulating in them. In order to conduct the heat from inside the space station to outside the space station, you've got to have the equivalent of a condenser and an evaporator. So,
No.
Okay. There's got to be some pipes on the inside. Oh, are you conducting all the heat from the inside to the outside by conduction? And there's not even an ammonia pipe inside the living quarters? Over to you, Paul.
They have ammonia pipes running to each one, but it's not a refrigeration system. It's you don't have an evaporator, you don't have a condenser, you don't have a TX valve, thermostatic expansion valve, you have no accumulators, nothing. It's a pump. It's a pump pushing the ammonia to and from the...
it's a simple heat exchanger.
So that's what they're doing. They have a pump box outside mounted on a truss. That's what I was saying earlier. There's no real evaporation system going on. The ammonia picks up the heat from the heat exchangers inside the nodes, and each node has a heat exchanger. Then they have not ammonia, but actual water flowing from the electronic circuits or inside the coils inside the different modules, collectively going to these heat exchangers. By the way, the 8 solar arrays that they have, each one is 112 feet by 39 feet. I always said 40 feet, but we'll call it 112 feet by 39 feet. And you have 8 sets of them, so it's like the size of, it's big, You could add up how many solar panels would be on somebody's house. And naturally, these are much more efficient. Somebody's house might be 30%. These are probably down in 20% numbers. Back to you, sir.
Dick, they might have radial tip fans on the internal heat exchangers, and they just increase the speed of the fans. That may have made up for the heat. What does the heat exchanger on the living quarters look like, Paul? You got ammonia fluid flowing from inside to outside to conduct the heat from inside to outside. What does the heat exchanger in the living quarters look like? Over here, Paul.
It's actually the external part of the nodes. You have unity, you have harmony, you have tranquility. No, the external parts of these things. No, you have these tanks, and I'm going to call them a tank, and then you have coils within inside that, so you have internal coils surrounded by external by an external tank. And, you know, one group goes up heat from the other. You know, they're heat exchanges. And the ammonia part goes outside, piped to a box, and inside the box they have all these different valves, and that's where the pumps are and electronics. And they've changed things out on those a couple of times. In fact, they bought one whole box set up back on a shuttle because they had problems. They wanted to find out what the leaks were and where the problems were. Back to you, Dick. I'm running out of time. Look at the clock here. Wow. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this was technet number 1,579 of the series that began in September of 1982, 33 years and 1 month ago. Hope you guys enjoyed it. We kind of did all kinds of things we never intend to today. Be kind to each other. Don't take this serious. This is a hobby. KC2WGB, you got it, John. K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us and for the questions. And everybody learns a little bit. Wonderful stuff. Have fun. Enjoy the hobby. And like Dick says, be kind. It's KC2WGB. Good night, Paul. Good night, Dick.
Just think, John. Each tech net, and to some degree, we haven't got the vaguest idea what we're going to be discussing that night. Thoroughly unplanned. What a crazy operation. How the hell can people get involved in a thing like this? Okay, John.
Yeah, it's sort of like some of the actors that go on stage in improv. We open up, we never know where we're going. It's like a cruise ship. We disconnect the anchors and untie from the docks, and we don't know where we're going. Good stuff, though.
As ham radio operators, we think we're studying electronics and radio. From another point of view, we have a fervent goal that is unclearly defined. If you don't know what your goal is, how do you know when you get there? We're always seeking. We never get there, Paul. We never get there, John.
Yeah, but at least we get somewhere. We don't know where we're going, but we sure arrive, that's for sure.
We're moving in random directions. It's a random bug walk. One of the problems they study in college quite often is that if you put a bug in the middle of the record on a record player, and he makes one step to the right, one step to the left, and one step backwards, and so on. If he randomly chooses the size of the steps and the direction of the steps, and you try to figure out where he's going to end up on average, the random bug walk. That's sort of what we're doing here, John.
Maybe you just need some tougher questions.
Yeah, there we go. Some tougher questions. No, thank you. But, yeah, Dick, it's sort of like watching the ants on an anthill. Are they really getting anything done? But they're sure moving along.
Yeah, they're really building something. I guess we're building an assemblage of knowledge. You can't make any money. Well, yes, you can. Yes, you can. You can make money with it. I know people who have made money with electronics. Bye-bye, you all.
Good night, all. KC2WGB clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
N2PPN and 2ZEP.
Zeddy P and PPN.
Good morning. Are you all rested from the weekend?
Yes. Yes, I am.
So another work week begins. It looks like in the middle of the week we're going to need rain here.
Oh, it's a little rain.
It makes the flowers grow.
Fills the reservoirs.
replenishes.